Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. This week we talk to two of Bristol's hard-working Hackney Carriage drivers. And we hear about a new guide to Bristol's churches, which has just gone online.
We have a local music review with singer-songwriter Lindsay Bullimore. Malcolm Grieve reads this week's episode of Treasure Island. We have poetry from Rosemary Dunn. And we also have the What Song Guide and Song of the Week brought to you by Jeff Sparks.
Dialect is produced by volunteers and we're broadcast in Bristol at least on BCFM and 93.2. We're also broadcast in Preston on Preston FM and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. The details of that will be at the end of the show. They plied the city streets night and day, and back in Easter, they were told they all had to turn blue. A particular shade of Bristol blue, apparently, or some will call it midnight blue, making them more difficult to see and potentially causing accidents. But that's not the way Lib Dem councillor Gary Hopkins saw it when he told Bristol cabbies that they either had to turn blue or lose their licences. Taxi drivers tried legal action, but that was not successful. And I'm joined by two Hackney Carriage drivers who are in the studio with me now. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
You are remaining anonymous.
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's first establish the difference. You're Hackney Carriage drivers. What does that actually mean? I mean, you also get private hire cabs as well.
Hackney Carriage means that as a licensed badge holder, you can ply the streets for hire and be flagged down between ranks, and private hire, they can only take telephone bookings only.
Okay. Are you more expensive than other forms?
Well, with a Hackney Carriage, you've got a lot more commitments and outgoings because you have to purchase very expensive vehicles, and these vehicles range, new ones, anything from £34,000 upwards, plus the VAT, and also you have to try and find one in the colour of Bristol blue, because if you don't, the Hackney Carriage won't consider it fit for the road, so it has to be sprayed blue or one in that colour, and by the time you finish paying for it, with the VAT and everything else and the colour respray if it needs one, you're talking some serious money.
Okay, what do we mean by serious money?
Well, you know, £34,000 for a new vehicle, plus the interest if you have it on the hire purchase, because nobody can pay cash for those sort of figures. And by the time you've paid for it over a period of 5 years, you're looking at a lot of money, and there's not enough work out there to cover these really high costs, especially with the cost of fuel. And
that's an incredibly low, especially when, you know, we're several years into a recession. How many Hackney Carriage drivers do you know who are actually going to go ahead with this?
Not too many, because every day it's difficult to make a living.
Yeah. I mean, what is the drive behind this? Why have they suddenly launched this on you?
We don't have any idea. I mean, to say, we've always had to have vehicles granted with a licence of a 10-year vehicle licence. Your licence is granted on an annual basis, and it expands for 10 years. Now, they can revoke this licence at any time during this period of time for any misdemeanours that they feel fit, and without any comebacks, you know, upon themselves. But if we do anything that they feel that you're an unfit and proper person, you can be hauled down before the Hackney Carriage Committee, and you have to explain yourself. And if they feel that it's relevant to take you off the road, they can suspend your licence with no comebacks to us whatsoever for any length of time. And it could be a week, it could be a month, it could be any amount of time. And they make up the sort of decisions of how your livelihood's affected by these
Can you appeal? Can you appeal?
Yes, you can appeal, and they take you to court, and then if they don't like the situation with the court hearings, they can overrule it, and it gets taken back to court again, or you're still in a sort of like no-win situation, which is not acceptable.
Does that make you feel like you have to be very cautious in your conduct in case anyone complains?
Yes, but I mean, conduct usually is common sense, and you know, it's abided by the rules, and you treat people with respect and they treat you back with respect, but the council doesn't treat us back with respect at all.
Okay. How is business going with the recession, the all-encompassing recession? Are you finding less people are taking fares?
Oh, taxi drivers and pub landlords and restaurants, they feel the first pinch of any, you know, recession or any improvement in the economy.
Okay. What other changes have been going on recently, you know, in the past couple of years to taxi driving? Is this the first big change that's come up on the horizon, or are they sort of constantly tinkering, as it were?
Going back approximately 4 years ago, we had to have a survey conducted, which we had to pay collectively on our licence fee, to say that there was no unmet demand for extra cabs out here. And the survey showed that then, that there was a drop-off of approximately 20% work situation, plus the amount of cabs that were out there, there was more than enough, and they only wanted roughly 10 licenses per year up until the next survey, which is going to be carried out. But they overruled all that, and allegedly they decided that they were going to throw the whole cab trade open to anybody that would like a license, providing that they met the Hackney Carriage rules and regulations and standards of vehicle and behaviour or whatever, and that they did a knowledge test of Bristol, which we've always had to do, and providing they passed this knowledge test, they would then be granted a license to ply the hire for hire on the streets of Bristol.
Okay, so you've got a recession and increase in competition at the same time.
Absolutely. Okay. And I feel that this is not good enough, because we've been on to the City Council by our association to get them to stop issuing licences, but they're quite adamant, as far as I know, that they're going to still carry on issuing licences regardless, and we can't get them to put a cap on it, and we can't sort of understand
why.
Do
you have a union?
We do, and it's working frantically behind the scenes to try and get all these things rectified. But not only myself and others out here, they're trying their hardest, but nobody seems to be getting anywhere, because the council just decides...
Have you thought about possibly throwing in as a Hackney Carriage driver and going for a private hire radio cab instead then?
Absolutely not, because when I started, I got my licence by working, first of all, as a private hire, and then eventually there was an opening to become a Hackney Carriage driver, but I had to work for somebody else, and you were put on a Hackney Carriage waiting list, and you could take anything up to 10 years to get a full Hackney Carriage licence, because you'd work for somebody else either on days or on nights, and then you'd move up on the list when the licences were handed back in or they'd had enough. And then you were given 3 months once you've risen to the top of the list to find out and say, would you like to become a fully fledged Hackney Carriage driver? And then you've got 3 months to make up your mind. And then they'd say, yes, you've got a full Hackney licence. And now you're totally owner driver and you're responsible for everything.
Okay, I understand you've also received letters recently dated the 4th of November from First Great Western about what's going on outside Temple Meads railway station. Explain to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, they've been going on for the last 6 months that they want to charge us roughly about £350 a year. I think we took them to court, or the council took them to court and thrown out in May, but we've been receiving letters recently again asking us to get a permit for the Temple Meads station. And I think what they're trying to do is get a few drivers to take on, accept the letter and apply the permit, so they break divide us between us.
Okay.
So they can go back to court and say, look, so many drivers are willing to get a permit.
Is that fair, just to suddenly say, well, now you've suddenly got to pay some money to be able to do what you've always been doing?
No, not at all. I mean to say, other stations, because they're privately owned, they charge Hackney Carriage drivers to actually work from the station. But Bristol is unique in as much as it's got a public Hackney Carriage rank right in the middle of the station approach, and there's a through road. Now, the argument is this through road an open public access or is it private? Well, they've decided in their letter that we've received that we will be ceased to trade because they say that it becomes a private road. Well, that's what we think, even though there's a rank still in there. And we don't know where we stand or where it's going, but I, for one, am definitely not paying.
Okay. It must be quite tempting for a lot of people, given the huge costs that they keep having to incur lately, threatening, to go illegal and not really get a licence. I mean, what happens if somebody does do that? Who's stopping them?
Nobody's stopping. It's already happening in Bristol City Centre. You can park outside the Hippodrome and don't have plates, nothing, no badges, nothing. People get in the cars and take them. It's really happening. An unfortunate thing is something bad happens to anyone. It would be all labelled as this, she got a taxi driver, such and such. But the licensing, people are not really coming out to check the licence.
So it's a very bleak landscape at the moment.
It's very, very bleak.
When you consider that we've gone over the last 5 years probably from 400 taxis to probably about 800 to 900, and we've got a surplus of roughly, I would say, roughly 400 too many cabs, because when you take all the ranks in the city, the ranks, there's approximately 200 ranks off the top of my head. And if they're all full up, once they're all full up, then you're supposed to move to the next available rank. And if they're all full up and they won't provide us with any more extra ranks, that's another thing that's a shame on Bristol City Council, because they're not looking after the needs and they're not protecting the licensed public hackney carriage trade, which they have a duty of care to do. So,
okay, well, to our two anonymous hackney carriage drivers, thank you very much for coming in, and hopefully we might hear more on this in the coming months and maybe some good news.
Thank you very much, Bristol
City Council, listen up. In recent weeks, Greece has been in the spotlight as it heads towards bankruptcy and a possible return to the drachma. But what is life like for the ordinary people struggling to come to terms with widespread poverty? Reporter Anthea Page finds out on a flight from Istanbul to Heathrow.
I'm flying from Istanbul to London Heathrow. I've met a Greek lady on the plane.
My name is Eugenia. I'm 25 years old. I'm travelling to London. For the last 2 months, I live in Izmir, where I'm studying Turkish. Instead of the rumors that saying that Greeks don't like the Turks. And the situation in Greece is a little worse than expected. I would like to say I'm sorry for my English. What I'm about to say, it is just my opinion. So basically, the last year, the government forced people to give up every penny they have. The government made everyone to give a lot of money in taxes, and this year they decided they want more money for taxes. The situation is getting worse and worse. People are out in the streets every day. Until now, only one person got killed.
Can you tell us why they got killed and how?
It was just an accident because he had a problem with his heart. So this was not because of the of any terrorism of any kind. It was just an accident for this one person. Every other way of expressing our dislike is expressed with people getting out in the streets. Nothing more.
Protesting.
Yeah. And, well, actually trying to tell our politicians that they should leave the country. Now it's time to leave the country, actually. I believe that 90% of the Greek population thinks that today's politicians are traitors. Nothing more.
Are people starving in Greece?
Right now, about 40% don't have a job. A lot of people I knew, they were just about right. Nowadays, they live with bread or some vegetables growing in their gardens. Many people are poor, are actually poor. A lot of them starve, a lot more than before, let's just say that. Walking around Athens is something to be very sad about. You can see everywhere people in the streets begging. You can see from other countries people begging because they cannot go back to their countries and they are in Greece but they don't work. Criminals are a lot more than they used to be. And generally, Greek people live in fear, which is something that makes me really angry, because in these days we should fight and not be afraid.
Are people supporting each other during this crisis, families?
Right now, they start to do that. We were raised with values that supported family, that supported loving each other, these kinds of ideas. Nowadays, we start feeling again this kind of love for each other. We want to give to the community as much as we have to, as much as we are able to give. But people are afraid, and that's not good. And they don't have to give anymore. They've given everything. In 2 years, the situation got like 80% worse than expected.
So do you think the situation will get even worse?
Yes. I think we're going to be just like Argentina.
So how will it end, this uncertainty and fear?
Well, I hope I knew. I believe Greek people always find a way at last to do something. I don't know what. I believe we will protest, and our protest will become a revolution, and our revolution will inspire the rest of the Europe, because, let's face it, we may be the problem now, but we are the first country in many countries in a row to have the same problem as us. I mean, we should see Ireland, we should see Spain, Portuguese people, they start to have the same reactions and the same problem with us. So I believe we are the first of a series of problems all around Europe, and they should find a solution. And if the politicians don't, we will, as people, as Greeks, as Spanish, as Europeans. We need to find a solution for that.
Tell us about your situation, because you're typical, yeah?
Well, I'm 25 years old, I'm an archaeologist in Greece, and I cannot find a job. This is ironic. This is ironic, really, because Greece is the first country in the world with so many antiquities. I hope I can find a way abroad, but it's been 3 years now in Greece that I haven't been able to find a job, any job, not an archaeological job only. I'm facing difficulty in general.
You were hoping to get married, but you can't even think about getting married.
It's been 7 years that I have a relationship, and we were thinking about our future and thinking about getting married and starting a family. But there's no point, really, because we don't know how to support this family. We don't have a job. We try to study a little more, to have more things in order to have more potential. But when money are a problem, they're always a problem. I mean, I cannot think of starting a family if I don't have the basic salary every month to support my family. I was thinking of about my choices.
Are all your friends in the same situation?
Well, most of them. I can give you an example. I have a lawyer, a friend who's a lawyer. She works 12 hours a day. She's paid 600 euros every month. She cannot live by herself. Her parents support her. Still, she's my age. She cannot move in with her boyfriend. She also cannot start a family, of course. And her bosses always say that it is a good thing that she still has a job. So every day things getting worse for everyone, for people who used to have money, for people that were not rich, but they weren't poor also. Another friend of mine has a little shop that sells sandwiches and coffees, and he had to stay closed for a week during the protests. He wasn't able to make the rent of the month because of that. So he now faces a difficulty, a financial difficulty. Everyone has problems, everyone. And people who want to work, and people who have ideas, and people who are willing, who have degrees from universities, they also can work. And if they can work, they make like 400 euros, 500 euros. You cannot live in Greece with 500 euros. At least 350 is only the rent. So you can imagine that a person in his 25 years old not being able to work and create something, this is a disaster. We cannot even dream. We cannot even think of our future anymore.
And if they removed the politicians, would that make any difference if you had new politicians?
Well, I really don't know. Right now, there's no one who can take charge and have a result with his actions as a politician. But we have to start from somewhere. And that somewhere is getting rid of all the traitors that for 20 years now, they sell our country. They seriously sell land to the big companies abroad. So they have to go, they have to leave. And I hope that through protesting, we can show the rest of Europe that something must be done in general.
What about the bankers? Were they part to blame? Like in England?
Of course they are part to blame, because they connect with the politicians, all of them. So if something happened to the politicians, I believe the whole system would break down and start from the beginning. Well, I imagine that this would be a solution anyway.
Is there anything else you want to add?
Well, I see that in England also the prices are getting higher for education and everything. So I'm thinking maybe this is a result from all this situation. If I had a dream to go to England and study there, my dream would be harder because of these prices, these new prices, because in 2012 the prices will be doubled. So I wanted to ask what English people could do about this. I was wondering what English people think about people coming from abroad to work in England. Will they have a part in this situation in Europe? Because they should have a part. They are in Europe, and it's not only financial, it's also political, a political thing. So I was wondering, as an English person, what do you think about your role in this whole situation? That's it.
Thank you to our reporter, Anthony Page, finding out about the situation in Greece while she was on a flight from Istanbul to Heathrow.
One of the less talked about reasons to live in Bristol is that it's well served with a variety of many kinds of different churches, from Greek to Polish, from the formal to the informal, to suit all tastes. Two Bristolians have taken it upon themselves to do a Bristol Good Church Guide, and Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to Bridget White about why she does what she does.
My name is Bridget White, and I work with Simon on the streets of Bristol. We travel around evangelising.
Now, you say evangelising. Does this mean really going up to people and trying to persuade them to become Christians? Because for a lot of people, that might be quite annoying.
We usually aim at the moment at young people on the streets. We bring literature and tracts and books, and we hand them out. We talk to young people, and we find they do gather around us, and they want to have their questions answered. So we tell them things they need to know that probably their parents or school teachers are not answering to their requirements. So
why do you do this?
We feel it's a call from God. Having run a drop-in for the homeless for 4.5 years, then we felt the next was on the street to meet some of the young people that maybe will go on the wrong road, drugs and drink and things like that. So we've aimed at them to try and help them and to answer their questions.
How do you actually communicate with God?
Well, through prayer, reading the Bible, and we have the Holy Spirit, and so we listen in to what God is saying, and he usually opens doors, and we know this is the way to go. So it's really just following his instructions.
From doctrine, you've got the Trinity, which is God the Father, which is the God of the Old Testament. You've got God the Son, which is Jesus from the New Testament. But this whole thing of the Holy Spirit, that's a little bit more mysterious. Can you just explain that?
Yes. When Jesus was leaving this world, he said to the disciples that he would send the Comforter, so we wouldn't be left on our own, and that we would have someone to help us to bring the gospel throughout the world until he returns. So that's what we are doing, really.
So it's almost like a kind of spirit of Jesus walking around, even though, of course, he has not actually been physically around for 2,000 years.
Yes, that's right. We feel that we're led through prayer and reading the scriptures, and that God opens doors and just shows us. I was passing College Green, and I felt that God said, you know, look at all those young people, and they need to be evangelized. So this is your next commission.
But don't you ever get people saying, just go away?
Yes, sometimes young people to begin with can be a bit unfriendly, but as the weeks go by and we get to know them, they really open up and they're very accepting of the gospel. It's really nice for them to have someone to talk to. Simon and I, we both talk to them and on their level and answer their questions.
A lot of youngsters really are not brought up now as our generation was. I mean, I was brought up in school in the 1960s and 70s, and we had an assembly every day. We would have a Christian element almost every single day to our education, particularly in primary school. Do you think it matters that children are now brought up not knowing who Moses was?
Yes, it does matter, because some of them have never known anything about God. Their parents don't go to church. And sometimes the parents' marriages break up and they want things answered and there's no one there for them. So we feel that we're there as spiritual leaders who can go out, who can talk to them and who can be there at this time. Because there isn't very much for young people these days. They're at a low ebb. Most of them don't go to church and never have been. And so there's a real lull in any teaching for them about God. And so we hope we fill that gap.
I noticed that on your website you're talking about cult churches. Well, what is a cult church? That sounds a bit worrying.
Yes, it is worrying, because in our travelling around the churches within the last year, we've gone to many, many churches, and from time to time we believe we have entered into cult churches that are operating in Bristol, and there's quite a few of them, and mainly they're talking about prosperity and they can be very controlling, and many people are locked into these operations.
So can you just describe to us, what is a cult?
A cult is a sort of a mind control situation where people stop using their own mind, and so the people that are leading the churches have full restriction over them because they've stopped using their own minds. So they're just being told what to do, and they're falling into that type of trap.
How can you tell if you go into a church if you think there might be problems with it?
It doesn't take very long to see that people are doing everything they're told. Sometimes we've noticed the pastors of these churches, at the wave of a hand, they can make people do what they want them to. Sit up, sit down, go here, go there.
Now, hang on a minute, because I've been to Church of England churches, and there you're standing up, sitting down, saying your prayers, you're doing what you're told, really, by the minister.
Yes, in those Church of England and Methodists and that, people, they have before them a written sermon, so they kind of know when to get up and down. But I think in some of these control churches, they're just told, sit up, sit down. It's just like a command. So you can usually tell very quickly because they're all in the same mindset, just following someone else's instructions. And sometimes we've noticed these leaders are not very friendly.
Bridget White there, who has helped prepare a Bristol Good Church Guide, about which we'll be hearing more next week. It's online at bristolgoodchurchguide.webs.com, and you can also contact Bridget at bristolundergroundchurch@yahoo.co.uk, and we'll give the website again at the end of the show. Our engineer Michael Noyce has been inviting musicians round to his house for a cup of tea and a chat, and also to record an exclusive live track. On the sofa this week is singer-songwriter Lindsay Bullimore.
On my sofa today I have Lindsay Bullimore, singer-songwriter.
Hello.
It's always difficult trying to characterise music, particularly, you know, you wouldn't want to pigeonhole yourself into a particular genre, and obviously singer-songwriter usually gives a certain kind of connotations, but is there any specific flavour you would say your music had? Or?
Well, I think I've got quite an eclectic range of influences really, but I grew up on a lot of pop music and things, so I think generally you could probably class my music as pop. But I don't think there's anything wrong with pop. So yeah, definitely a bit of pop, and I guess it's sort of been called a bit folky and sort of general sort of acoustic brand really. But yeah, I think I am a bit poppy, which I like, so it's all right.
Okay, so how would you actually go about writing your music?
It varies really. I did a course last year, year before last, MA sort of songwriting course. So we learned a lot of different methods about writing, and you have to sort of write under pressure and write for deadlines. So then, I don't know, you start experimenting with the idea of sort of starting with a title. That's sort of a really good way of writing because it immediately sort of summarises what you're going to write about. And then from there, you can kind of work out the story and make sure that it's going to make sense, you know, to a listener. But then sometimes, especially because I started writing when I was probably about 15 and, you know, and things aren't quite going right, and sort of it's a way of expressing yourself. So sometimes it'll just be, you know, I'll find that my first lyrics are actually the bridge that I've written first, you know, and then everything else will build around that really. So it depends a little bit. Oh yeah, and sometimes guitar. Yeah, I'll play a little bit on guitar and there'll be like an interesting chord that kind of has that sort of feeling of suspense or sort of a really sad note in it, and it makes you feel a certain way, and then you kind of think about what's going on at the moment or something that you've read about or something that your friend's going through, and then that will kind of lead to a song. So it varies quite a lot really. I've tried quite a few methods. I think it's good for a songwriter to try and find a method that you're good at, what helps you write songs well, and stick to it. And I've been trying to do that for years, but I still seem to randomly have different ways of writing songs. But yeah, normally lyrics first, I guess.
So how do you get your music out there? Do you doing gigs or?
I do, yeah. I live in Bristol, so there's a couple of promoters that we work with that often put on showcases. So we do sort of half hour slots, and then I run an open mic night as well, so I kind of get to meet a lot of people through that. And general pubs, there's so many options in Bristol for music, it's brilliant, you know. So there's always an open mic night every night of the week on my road, on Gloucester Road, so there's always places to do that, and then booking little slots. And then I did some recording last year, so I've got a Bandcamp account and MySpace and Facebook, that kind of thing. But yeah, generally it's sort of playing live and doing little slots around Bristol.
So obviously at the moment you're not going to be able to actually make a living off your music just yet. So what do you actually do in the meantime?
Well, I'm kind of doing lots of bits at the minute, which is sort of what I always wanted to do really. So obviously, yeah, I've got like the open mic and things. And then in the summer, I worked for a company called Chaiwallahs who go around festivals. It's like a big tent with cafe and shishas and then sort of a big stage. So a lot of the acts that play on the stage in the summer, we sort of help do bookings and things for in the winter. So I'm doing some sort of internship there at the minute, which is really good. It sort of opens up your eyes really to a lot of bands that are, you know, so talented, really, really good, and that influences you quite a lot, really. But it's sort of quite the idea of, you know, independent bands working that aren't selling out for money and things. Everyone that works there kind of all does it because they love it, you know, and they see a brighter future, really. Yeah, it's brilliant, yeah, place to work.
So I think you've got some recordings already.
Yes.
You've got some more coming up as well, I gather.
Yes, hopefully. I recorded my own album last time, so I kind of took on role of writer and singer and obviously guitarist, and then ended up obviously recording it and mixing it and then attempting to master it. And sometimes I think you can take on too much, really. You can end up sort of being a little bit good at lots of things. Whereas, you know, I think as a sort of singer-songwriter, it's good if you can focus on the music and obviously the people
that the producers work with you.
You know, so I'm going to obviously try more of that approach this time and do a little EP, hopefully, before Christmas.
Okay, fantastic. And I gather you're going to play us a song now that might well be on your EP.
Yes, I am. I wrote this song a while ago. I was chatting to a friend, actually, at the festivals, and there was this guy I liked, and it was a very short-lived thing. But I kind of felt all right about it, and then I think she sort of said, "Ah, sometimes the shortest times can be the sweetest with someone." I thought it was a really nice way of looking at things, so I kind of developed a song around it, really. And then, yeah, so that's going to be recorded along with another four songs, I think.
Okay, so this is Lindy Bullimore with "Sweetest."
I know that I was meant to meet you, but I didn't know that I'd have to leave you. But people come and go for a reason. The shortest times can be the sweetest. Come and go for a reason.
Yeah, that was Sweetest by Lindsay Bullimore. So if anyone does like what they see and wants to contact you for gigs or buy anything off you, have you got any contact details?
I have. On my MySpace, it goes under Lindsay and the Limpets. It's kind of a collaboration idea I had a while ago. But if you search for Lindsay and the Limpets on either MySpace,
and
Facebook,
how are you spelling Lindsay?
Right, well, we're spelling it L-I-N-Z-I, and then and the, and Limpets, L-I-M-P-E-T-T-S. And I think if you go to www.bandcamp.com/Lindsay and the Limpets, then you can find it on there and download it for free.
Okay, well, Lindsay Bullimore, thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Lindsay Bullimore talking to Michael Noyce.
Treasure Island by Scottish author Robert Louis Stevenson was first published in its entirety on 23rd of May 1883. Much of the action takes place in the 17th century in English taverns and bars, some, if we are to be believed, are based on pubs which still exist today. Brislington's Hole in the Wall may be Stevenson's model for his Spyglass Tavern, and the Landlord's Trough on King Street is often claimed to be the inspiration for Stevenson's Admiral Benbow. However, that may be no more than a myth, because an actual Admiral Benbow pub does exist in Penzance and Cornwall. It's a 17th century inn, and that arguably does have a better claim. So without further ado, Malcolm Grieve reads this week's episode of Treasure Island, Chapter 26, Part 1.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 5, My Sea Adventure. Chapter 26, Israel Hands. The wind, serving us to a desire, now hauled into the west. We could run so much the easier from the northeast corner of the island to the mouth of the North Inlet. Only, as we had no power to anchor, and dared not beach her until the tide had flowed a good deal farther, time hung on our hands. The coxswain told me how to lay the ship to. After a good many trials, I succeeded, and we both sat in silence over another meal. "Captain," said he at length, with that same uncomfortable smile, "here's my old shipmate, O'Brien. Suppose you was to heave him overboard. I ain't particular as a rule, and I don't take no blame for settling his hash. But I don't reckon him ornamental now. Do you? I'm not strong enough, and I don't like the job. And there he lies for me," said I. "This here's an unlucky ship, this Hispaniola, Jim," he went on, blinking. "There's a power of men been killed in this Hispaniola. A sight of poor seamen dead and gone since you and me took ship to Bristol. I never seen such dirty work, not I. There is this here O'Brien now. He's dead, ain't he? Well, now, I'm no scholar, and you're a lad as can read and figure. And to put it straight, do you take it as a dead man is dead for good? Or do he come alive again?
You can kill the body, Mr. Hands, but not the spirit. You must know that already," I replied. "O'Brien there is in another world and may be watching us."
"Ah," says he, "well, that's unfortunate. Appears as if killing parties was a waste of time. Howsomever, spirits don't reckon for much, by what I've seen. I'll chance it with the spirits, Jim, and now you spoke up free, and I'll take it in kind if you'd step down into that there cabin and get me a shiver me timbers, I can't hit the name on. Well,
You get me a bottle of wine, Jim. This here brandy's too strong for the head. Now, the coxswain's hesitation seemed to be unnatural, and as for the notion of his preferring wine to brandy, I entirely disbelieved it. The whole story was a pretext. He wanted me to leave the deck, so much was plain, but with what purpose I could in no way imagine. His eyes never met mine. They kept wandering to and fro, up and down, now with a look to the sky, now with a flitting glance upon the dead O'Brien. All the time he kept smiling and putting his tongue out in the most guilty, embarrassed manner, so that a child could have told he was bent on some deception. I was prompt with my answer, however, for I saw where my advantage lay, and that, with a fellow so densely stupid, I could easily conceal my suspicions to the end. "Some wine," I said. "Far better. Will you have white or red?"
"Well, I reckon it's about the blessed same to me, shipmate,"
he replied.
"So it's strong and plenty of it. What's the odds?"
"All right," I answered. "I'll bring you port, Mr. Hans, but I'll have to dig for it." With that, I scuttled down the companion with all the noise I could, slipped off my shoes, ran quietly along the sparred gallery, mounted the forecastle ladder and popped my head out of the fore companion. I knew he would not expect to see me there, yet I took every precaution possible, and certainly the worst of my suspicions proved too true. He had risen from his position to his hands and knees, and though his leg obviously hurt him pretty sharply when he moved, for I could hear him stifle a groan, yet it was at a good rattling rate that he trailed himself across the deck. In half a minute he had reached the port scuppers and picked out of a coil of rope a long knife, or rather a short dirk, discoloured to the hilt with blood. He looked upon it for a moment, thrusting forth his underjaw, tried the point upon his hand, and then hastily concealing it in the bosom of his jacket, trundled back again into his old place against the bulwark. This was all that I required to know. Israel could move about. He was now armed. And if he had been at so much trouble to get rid of me, it was plain that I was meant to be the next victim. What he would do afterwards, whether he would try to crawl right across the island from North Inlet to the camp among the swamps, or whether he would fire Long Tom, trusting that his own comrades might come first to help him, was, of course, more than I could say. Yet I felt sure that I could trust him in one point, since in that our interests jumped together, and that was in the disposition of the schooner. We had both desired to have her stranded safe enough in a sheltered place, and so that, when the time came, she could be got off again with as little labour and danger as might be. And until that was done, I considered that my life would certainly be spared. While I was thus turning the business over in my mind, I had not been idle with my body. I had stolen back to the cabin, slipped once more into my shoes, and laid my hand at random on a bottle of wine. And now, with this for an excuse, I made my reappearance on the deck. Hans lay as I had left him, all fallen together in a bundle, and with his eyelids lowered as though he were too weak to bear the light. Knocked the neck off the bottle, like a man who had done the same thing often, and took a good swig, and with his favourite toast of "Here's luck." Then he lay quiet for a while, and then pulling out a stick of tobacco, begged me to cut him a quid. "Cut me a junk of that," says he, "for I haven't no knife, and hardly strength enough, so be as I had. Ah, Jim, Jim, I reckon I've missed stays. Cut me a quid as'll likely be the last, lad, for I'm for my long home, and no mistake." "Well," said I, "I'll cut you some tobacco. But if I were you, and thought myself so badly, I would go to my prayers like a Christian man."
"Why?"
said he.
"Now, you tell me why."
"Why?" I cried. "You were asking me just now about the dead. You've broken your trust. You've lived in sin and lies and blood. There's a man you killed lying at your feet this moment. And you ask me why? For God's mercy, Mr. Hans, that's why." I spoke with a little heat, thinking of the bloody dirk he had hidden in his pocket and deigned in his ill thoughts to end me with. He, for his part, took a great draught of the wine and spoke with the most unusual solemnity.
"For 30 years, he said, "I've sailed the seas and seen good and bad, better and worse, fair weather and foul, provisions running out, knives going and what not. Well, now I tell you, I never seen good come a goodness yet. Him as strikes first is my fancy. Dead men don't bite. Them's my views. Amen. So be it. And now you look here," he added, suddenly changing his tone. "We've had about enough of this foolery. The tide's made good enough by now. You just take my orders, Captain Hawkins, and we'll sail slap in and be done with it."
All told, we had scarce 2 miles to run, but the navigation was delicate. The entrance to this northern anchorage was not only narrow and shoal, but lay east and west, so that the schooner must be nicely handled to be got in. I think I was a good, prompt subaltern, and I am very sure that Hans was an excellent pilot, for we went about and about, and dodged in, shaving the banks, with a certainty and a neatness that were a pleasure to behold. Scarcely had we passed the heads before the land closed around us. The shores of the North Inlet were as thickly wooded as those of the southern anchorage, but the space was longer and narrower, and more like what in truth it was, the estuary of a river. Right before us, at the southern end, we saw the wreck of a ship in the last stages of dilapidation. It had been a great vessel of 3 masts, but had lain so long exposed to the injuries of the weather that it was hung about with great webs of dripping seaweed, and on the deck of it shore bushes had taken root and now flourished thick with flowers. It was a sad sight, but it showed us that the anchorage was calm.
"Now," said Hans, "look here, there's a pet bit for to beach a ship in. Fine, flat sand, never a cat's paw. Trees all round of it, and flowers are blowing like the garden on that old ship."
"And once beached," I inquired, "how shall we get her off again?"
"Why so," he replied, "you take a line ashore there on the other side at low water. Take a turn about one of them big pines, bring it back, take a turn round the capstan, and lie to for the tide. Come high water, all hands take a pull upon the line, and off she comes, as sweet as nature. And now, boy, you stand by. We're near the bit now, and she's too much way on her. Starboard a little. So, steady. Starboard. Larboard a little. Steady. Steady."
So he issued his commands, which I breathlessly obeyed, till all of a sudden he cried, "Now, my hearty, luff!" And I put the helm hard up, and the Hispaniola swung round rapidly and ran stem on for the low wooded shore.
That was Chapter 26, Part 1 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, read excellently for us by Malcolm Grieve. Thank you very much.
I'm now joined by Rosemary Dunn.
Hello.
And you have some poetry for us, I believe?
I do, yes. I have one book from my collection of football poets called Oranges at Halftime. And it's a poem called My Foot's in My Mouth. It's a collection of actual quotes from football players, managers and pundits. So it's a kind of list poem. "Let's close our eyes and see what happens. That defender is very deceptive. He must be lightning slow. If God had wanted us to play in the clouds, he would have put grass up there. Strangely, in slow motion replay, the balls seem to hang in the air for even longer. Lombardo speaks much better English than what people realise. He dribbles a lot and the opposition don't like it. You can see it on their faces. If it had gone in, it would have been a goal. For those of you watching in black and white, Spurs are in the yellow strip. Dumbarton player Stephen Cahill has limped off with a badly cut forehead. There's nobody fitter at his age except Raquel Welch. I can see the carrot at the end of the tunnel. I'd like to play an Italian club like Barcelona. We probably got on better with the likes of Holland, Belgium, Norway and Sweden, some of whom are not even Europeans. Football's not a matter of life and death. It's more important than that.
Thank you very much, Rosemary.
Thank you.
Time for the What's On Guide. He wasn't supposed to be here, but actually he is. So, Jess Box, hello.
Hello, this is What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Thursday, 17th of November, the founding member of Mott the Hoople and Bad Company, Mick Rolfs, will be performing with his blues band and with support from Graham Mack Rock Band at the Victoria and Victoria Road, Swindon. Tickets are £10 in advance and £12 on the door, and doors open at 8 p.m. On Friday, 18th of November, the Communicators will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Nirvana. This group formed in 1965 and during their career released two albums before splitting up in 1971. They did reform in 1985 and are still working to this day in one way or another. This is from the compilation album, Travelling on a Cloud, and it's the song Rainbow Chaser. That was Nirvana with Rainbow Chaser from the compilation album Travelling on a Cloud. Into Saturday, 19th of November, Discharge will be performing with support from Sick Pig and also Murder of Crows at the Fleet in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 20th of November, the Randy Swindlers will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and doors open at 4 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, no mention of goldfish don't bounce or alien stash tin this week. Bristol is a poorer place.
Well, that's all for this week from Dialect. It's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Sunday at 2 p.m. It's also broadcast in Preston on Preston FM and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or our email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio1word.co.uk.
For all three of our listeners, as promised, Bristol Good Church Guide online that we mentioned earlier, bristolgoodchurchguide.webs.com. Thank you very much to our studio guests, our Bristol Hackney Carriage drivers who wish to remain anonymous, and Rosemary Dunn. Our reports this week were Anthea Page and Jess Bartz gave us the What's On Guide, and the studio production was by Michael Noyce. We also had Malcolm Grieve, who read another episode of Treasure Island, Chapter 26, Part 1, Part 2 next week. The producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute, so if you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 and you can also find that on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman.
If we're born in a world of destruction, it's not my fate to be led by corruption. And even if we try to fight, who ever said we even had the right? So just take a look in our eyes, all you'll find is a devil inside. All this pain that you demonstrate, don't tell me the reason life is to procreate. And there's no way out from what we've done. It's only the rich that get any fun. Can't you see what we've begun? All I want is my right to bun. It's not like your money and hate can help compensate with my mental state. Everything you say is fake. We're getting way too loud, trying to make our fathers proud. So let's find a place to start, trying to buy drugs with a community care grant. Writing poetry in the dark, trying to find light in the shady park. And if it's hell that we create, I don't let my destiny be ruled by fate. I'm screaming out loud, can't hear my voice. It's the way I'm living, but it's not my choice. And there's no way out from what we've done. It's only the rich that get any fun. Can't you see what we've begun? All I want is my right to bun. It's not like your money and hate can help compensate with my mental state. Everything you say is fake. We're getting way too loud, trying to make our fathers proud.
Cool. Cheers, guys. Jake Edwards. Well, I'm homeless, actually. I'm just, homeless guitarist guy. Yeah, cool. Thank you.